Welcome to This Is Money, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, down valuations are on the rise. What happens if you and your mortgage lender don't agree on your new home's value? Meanwhile, how much more would you be willing to pay to be in a good school's catchment area? Also today, are you saving enough for your age? Move over Swiftonomics. It's all about Oasonomics here in the UK. And Lee's favourite, supermarket self-checkout cameras. Are they even legal? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, down valuations are on the rise and they can seriously scupper a home sale. Now, this is where a valuation on the property by your mortgage lender concludes that it's actually worth less than the price that you've agreed to pay for it. It can result in the lender turning down your mortgage offer or a home buyer or seller having to renegotiate the price or indeed borrow more. The most shocking part is that often the valuer doesn't even step inside the home and instead simply drives past it or looks for it online. Now, brokers across the industry have said valuers have become overly cautious with their estimates at a time when property prices are flatlining. Lee, Simon, welcome. Lee, just explain to us, if you would, valuations. How do they work? What are they? What point do they happen? How important are they?
It's quite a murky business, this, and actually for something that's so important as getting the price of what is probably going to be the most expensive thing you're going to buy, right, it's surprisingly kind of feels a bit archaic. A lot of these valuations are based on what has sold around the area. As you say, quite often they just do a drive past. They don't actually go in and sort of kick the tires of the home and properly get under the skin to get a valuation. So essentially what it is that you go and have a look around properties, you find one you want to buy, you make an offer on it. You might already have a mortgage offer in place, you probably have, so you know what you can borrow and what you can afford to buy. Then the lender will want to ensure that they're not lending you money on an overinflated house price. But that's very difficult to run the rule over because you have agreed this price because that's what you think it's worth. But banks obviously have to cover themselves because they don't want to, you know, find that the property is worth less than what the mortgage is out for, and people can get in all sorts of difficulties. Now, in this story that Ed Magnus did for us, our mortgage reporter, there's quite a lot of anecdotal evidence, especially in London and the South East, that there's been some wildly fluctuating valuations that have been done. But for example, here we've got Adam Starrs, managing director of a London-based mortgage broker, Helix Financial Partners, says three of his customers have properties downvalued by over £1 million in recent weeks.
Whoa!
We've had some atrocious valuations of late. One valuer went round to value two finished new builds and gave a value of £1.7 million. We then took the deal to another lender that instructed a different valuer, who 2 weeks later valued the properties at £2.8 million. That's a £1.1 million difference in value.
Wow.
Crazy. And then there's some other sort of smaller examples in here. Director of a foreign-based broker, SJ Mortgages, Jake Tutton. So we've seen a high number of down valuations that we've experienced for a long while. Recently, we had a survey placed for a value on a property of £250,000 in March, only to reduce this to £225,000 in June. I'm not aware of anywhere in the UK where the housing market has reduced by 10% in such a short period of time. And he says that he accepts that agents and sellers might sometimes inflate the value of a property, but in general, he thinks at the moment values are being overly cautious down to the sort of stagnant property market. Now, it's an interesting one, the property market at the moment, because we're saying stagnant, flatlining, but it's a very different regional picture depending on where you are. And the nervousness, it seems like, is around London and the South East, where property prices are typically far higher than they are elsewhere, but it doesn't give much confidence into the market, and it makes people a bit nervier. But on the flip side, a bank has to make sure that they're doing the correct due diligence, and that the property that they're lending on is going to be, what they expect for the prices being paid. But let's say, for example, you're buying a home for 400 grand. And you've got a 10% deposit, so 40 grand. If one of these valuers comes over and says, well, actually, it's only worth 360, so that might mean the lender then will only be prepared to lend on 90% or 360 grand instead, so 324 grand. You've got a massive gap there, and the decision is, do you try and bridge the gap with your own funds? It's probably unlikely if you've got a 10% deposit, because you would have probably used it anyway onto a deposit. Or do you try and haggle with the seller and say, hey, look, the valuer and the lender are saying, actually, this house is worth this much, will you accept this instead? And then you're at the risk of seriously annoying the seller. So it's an interesting thing, and it kind of goes in peaks and troughs, I'd say, Georgie. Sometimes feels like the property market does get in these times where it gets overly cautious. The house price indexes are all pointing at different things. There's been all sorts of kind of those forward estimates have been revised by some of the companies, saying actually house price growth isn't going to be as strong as what was expected. But as far as I'm aware, I haven't seen any estimates from any of the mainstream kind of companies that are fully embedded in the property market, saying there's going to be a huge crash coming. Why would they be saying that? But this is what, is the kind of nervousness around the market, isn't it? And also, it comes at the same time when big banks are saying, hey, you can come borrow more money off us. We're loosening affordability criteria. Come and borrow more from us. So it's a lot of mixed messages, I would say, at the moment. Property market this year has felt incredibly strange.
Yeah, weird, isn't it? Simon, the last thing you want to do is overspend on a property. So you trust the lender to go, Georgie, don't be paying more than you should do, because it might come to bite you in the bum. But having read Ed's article, the part where the valuer doesn't even step inside your home, they might look for something similar online in your street, in your neighbourhood, simply drive past it. What?
Right. So the first mistake people make with mortgage valuations is they think that the valuer is acting for them. The valuer is not acting for you as the buyer. You might be paying for the valuation. That might be part of your mortgage deal. And it usually is. And even when you don't pay for it, it will be because the mortgage deal offers free valuation, i.e., they're doing you a favor. But you could be paying 250 quid, for example, for this valuation. But don't think the valuer is acting for you. The valuer is acting for the bank or the building society. The valuer is trying to ascertain whether that bank or building society, as Lee explained, will get their money back if they have to repossess the property and sell it on. There's obviously a margin of error there, depending on how much you're borrowing against the property. So it's more of an issue if you're borrowing 90%, it's less of an issue if you're borrowing 60%. And there's an ebb and flow. It depends how well the property market's doing. Most of the time, most valuations are absolutely fine. What it means is that if the lender's happy with the situation, then that's okay. Now, you might not be happy with the drive-by valuation or the idea that it's happening. You might think that because you've paid your 250 quid, that person should go around the house. But that's what your survey's for. That's what you pay your surveyor for to do. And they will give you a valuation on the property when you pay for a survey, whichever level of survey that you get. The one with the valuation, as I said, is acting for the mortgage lender. However, if it does come in materially lower than what you're meant to be paying, and you think there is a problem, you can challenge it, and you can then say to the mortgage lender, did you do a drive-by, or did you go and look at the property? If you actually look at the property, these are the reasons why it's worth more than what your drive-by valuation says, because you're comparing it to properties that aren't actually directly similar. Perhaps it's bigger, it's better, it's on a better plot, it's got a better garden. The comparators that you've used, are not actual direct comparators, because bear in mind, there's not that many homes that get sold. There's less homes that get sold nowadays. And so it is quite hard to find directly comparable properties. So you could challenge it, and you could then say, I want you to send somebody around the property. There's no guarantee the mortgage lender will actually do that, but you can definitely challenge it and get that to happen. And to give an illustration of valuations and the kind of finger in the air thing that goes on here, I'll tell you two stories of valuations from my own personal experience. On the second flat that me and my wife owned in London, we needed to remortgage. And when we remortgaged, it was to First Direct, who at the time charged different valuation fees depending on the value of the property. So if you went through the £500,000 mark, you had to pay an extra, something like an extra 150 quid. The valuation fee went up from like 250 to 400, something like that. These are not accurate numbers, right? So I was like, well, that's a bit much, isn't it? I was like, oh, they're not even going to come around the flat. They're just going to do a drive-by. I think I even asked them and they were like, yeah, they probably won't come around. I was like, pff. So because it didn't make any difference to the mortgage rate we were going to get in terms of our loan to value, when I put in the how much is your property worth thing, I just wrote £500,000. It was worth more than that. Like, if they'd done a proper valuation, they would have come back and said it was worth more than that. Just got signed off. They were like, fine, tick the box. I was like, funny that. And actually, people will find this. Valuations can be suspiciously close to what you're paying, i.e., our first flat, we paid, what did we pay? Oh, this is going to say, I'm really sorry to everybody listening to this, okay, who is of a, like, you know, kind of generation of home buyers below me. All right. We paid £228,000. Weirdly, valuation came in at exactly £228,000. I mean, how do you do
Wow.
that? How do you know it's worth
Wouldn't you
exactly
believe it? Wouldn't you
228?
know?
Would you believe it? The flat's worth 228. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. The other one is that we bought our house during the pandemic, but like right at the start of the pandemic. So we had agreed to buy it, had an offer accepted in February of 2020 before, lockdown, pandemic, chaos, when nobody thought we were going into lockdown. Then we went into lockdown at the end of March. Property market went into deep freeze. We couldn't do anything during that period. We had managed to get the valuation done beforehand and the survey done before lockdown started. I think the survey was weirdly done like maybe the Friday before the lockdown started on the Monday or something. It was like, and nobody knew kind of thing. So we had all of that back, and the property market goes into a deep freeze. Everybody thought the property market was going to absolutely tank off the back of that. We thought that we had basically just signed up to lose 100 grand. You know, it's like if we go through with this, we're going to end up instantly with something that's not worth what we agreed to pay for it when the world was very different in February. So we spoke to our surveyor, who we got to do a full survey on the house. And I said to him, can you do us a new valuation? This was after things reopened in kind of May time. And he said, I can't. He said, we can't. He said, we just cannot do valuations at the moment. We have no idea what anything is worth. He's like, there's the comparator prices, but that was all before this madness kicked off. Now that this madness has kicked off, we don't know what's going to happen. We literally have no idea. And I wouldn't be happy to take your money off you and give you a valuation because I just cannot put an accurate number on it. So that shows the other end of the stick from the whole, like, yeah, tick box, exactly what you said you're going to pay for it. So yeah, valuation's not that scientific, it turns out.
How disappointingly, especially if you're on the receiving end of it. So what can you do? Can you contest it? What are your next steps? Should we go as a buyer and then as a seller?
Yeah, so we've got a few steps outlined in this story that Ed did actually. So the first thing you can do, as we hinted at earlier in the show, in negotiating a new price with a seller that both parties can work with. The crucial bit of that is the price that both parties can work with. Second thing is you can find a new lender that will offer the mortgage amount that you need. You can increase the size of your deposit from your savings, although that's going to probably be quite difficult, especially for first-time buyers. Bridge the gap with money from friends or family. Walk away and find a new property. Them are the options, really. And then as a seller, you can consider lowering the sale price or meeting somewhere in the middle, but that feels like quite a drastic step when you've kind of had your home valued by an estate agent and you've got it in your mind that it's worth X amount. And then if you're stepping up the ladder, it's the maths that goes towards taking that next step up the ladder. Encourage the buyer to try another lender with different lending criteria. If the numbers don't work for you, get estate agents or solicitors to negotiate reductions or new deals up the chain. So, that does happen quite a bit, actually. I think if you kind of say, well, yeah, okay, we can accept 20 grand less on this if further up the chain it works out. That other parties are willing to do that, but it can get quite complicated, and can get quite complex, and it just takes one of the chain to say no to put that all to bed, really. Put your property back on the market and try to find a new buyer who can offer the required amount. Easier said than done. When you find someone to buy your house, like typically it's a bit of a weight off your shoulders. You're kind of happy. You found someone. You can kind of now start thinking about. But there's a real estate agent speak at the moment. It's all about being proceedable. It feels like it's like a bit robotic. Are you proceedable? And I think that. But essentially, when you've got people coming to look at your home, you want buyers that are proceedable, aka they've got all of the financing in place. They might have sold their home, and you can get the ball rolling on the whole process because it is a proper process, George, isn't it? As I think we all know, it takes a lot out of you. There's a lot of admin. There's a lot of moving parts. And the last one, I love this. Just look for a cash buyer. Oh, easy. Just find a cash buyer. I do. Cash buyers typically ask for a discount anyway for being cash buyers, mainly because it's a smoother process. There's not as many moving parts, and a cash buyer for a lot of people is the dream because they're the easiest people really to deal with. To be honest, though, first time buyers are pretty easy to deal with as well because they typically don't. Obviously, they don't have a chain below them. It has.
Whenever you say cash buyer, Lee, I always just think someone with a massive wallet of like hundreds of thousands just whacking it on the. Yeah, not quite like that.
A bit like football transfers. You imagine sort of like a massive suitcase of
The
cash just
dodgy
like,
ones in the brown paper.
It's not the case of someone just knocking on your door. I've got £380,000 in this suitcase full of 50 notes.
Take
Do you
it.
accept? No, I mean, it's not quite as that would actually be a nightmare doing that, trying to pay that into the bank these days. God knows what kind of checks you'd have to go through on that. No, more that people have that obviously the savings in the bank and they can just wire it over without having to use a lender just for the sake of any doubt of anyone listening actually thinking
Thanks for
that's
that,
sorry, it's got a bit simplistic, hasn't it? But those are the things that can be done, but it can be a real headache. And it seems
Absolutely
like it's
right.
back on the rise a little bit at the moment, just because of the nervousness around the property market. And it's kind of hard to really justify and really get under the bonnet of a house to say it's truly worth this. I mean, what do you do? Do you have a checklist of hundreds of things and you go, oh, boiler looks like I might pack in soon, let's take off a grand, or it's like you'd be going on and on and on. These surveys would take absolutely ages to go through. It's kind of, I like to think as a buyer, you've gone through a certain checklist of, you've seen lots of homes in the area, you've got a kind of upper limit of what you're willing to pay, you've seen 10, 15, 20 homes potentially, you found the one you want to buy. There must be a reason that you want to buy that one, and they're all going to be probably relatively the same price point. So you've actually probably got as much experience as a surveyor in that little local area, the little pocket, because you've probably set up right move alerts. You've probably really have got the tires on the lots of different homes around the area. So yeah, it's a tricky one. I've always found it quite a kind of funny business.
Daft question, Lee. Can't you just have like a an independent that works? Because Simon said it doesn't work for you, it works for the lender. Well, can't you have one that works for every party involved?
But it's the
Or would
lender
that just be
that's
financially difficult to work out, like how who
it's
pays
it's
and
it's
whatever?
it's the lender that you're taking a huge chunk of cash from. It's them protecting themselves, isn't it? It's not kind of them. It also protecting the buyer as well from overpaying and potentially being stuck in that
Yeah,
negative
exactly.
equity. So I think that in principle sounds simple, but in practice it isn't, because really it is about the lender covering their own backside, and making sure that they're not dishing out loads of mortgages for overinflated homes. But then lots of people would
All
say
right.
house prices in this country are already overinflated, so what's the difference?
Quite. And talking about overinflated house prices in certain areas. Let's go there next, because parents looking to live near a top state school and paying a few bob extra is, well, it's nothing new. We've spoken about it before, but Labour's VAT hike on private schools has driven up competition, and that's having an impact on prices of homes in certain catchment areas. Question is, how high would you be willing to go, Simon? Firstly, the increased competition due to Labour's VAT hike, what impact is that really having? Are we seeing kids coming out of schools?
It is genuinely having an impact. There's a reason why. And it's not necessarily to do with kids who are already at private schools being pulled out of them. And in fact, there's probably less of that going on at the moment than there is the other thing, which is kids not going to private school in the first place. So once children are at school, parents are incredibly reluctant to remove them from the school or get them to move schools. Whenever you read the woe is me, I'm on a six figures and I've hardly got any money, and we've had to scrimp and save to do everything, quite often in there is the mention of school fees, right? And you look at it and you're like, yeah, well, I mean, you're probably looking at 15 or 20 grand a year per kid. So if you've got two kids, that's 40 grand a year. If you're a six figure earner, you're going to have to earn nearly 100 grand just to pay the school fees. I can see the problem here. Maybe move the kids to state school. But understandably, as a parent, I say this as well, the last thing you'd want to do is move your kids out of school. That's, you feel you're letting your kids down. Socially, education, disruption, the lasting effects of that. So you do anything you can not to move them out of school. I think that we probably will see in years to come more kids being pulled out of schools, but I think it's too early for that to be happening. What is happening, though, is some parents are making a decision not to send their kids to private school in the first place. And quite often, this is secondary schools, which is where the catchment area issue is the biggest thing. And this is because, firstly, the cost has obviously gone up by 20% on top of fees that are already very, very high, and we're pushing certain parents to breaking point. Also, parents don't trust that the government isn't going to come after them for more money. So they think that probably taxes are going to go up. They feel there's going to be more of a squeeze on them wherever they can get at them, because the government has promised not to raise certain taxes. And therefore, if it doesn't raise income tax and things like that, then it's going to freeze thresholds. It's going to go after more capital gains, it's going after inheritance tax, all those other things, right? So they're very concerned about this tax squeeze. And I think there's also a concern that the government will go after private schools for more. I don't know how it could go after private schools for more, and I don't think it will go after private schools for more, but you can understand why parents have that concern in their head. So they look at this and they go, right, I've got little Johnny or little Jenny. He or she is 11 years old. They're about to start secondary school. I've got a choice here. Do we go for private, which is what we wanted to try and do? We were going to like really push it to get there. Because bear in mind, like this fees thing, it doesn't affect the really rich people. The really rich people can afford private school. It's the people kind of at the lower end of the rich, the high earners, but who are basically just high earning middle class people. And they're the ones who've been hit hardest by VAT. They go like, right, so we either do this, or do we try to get them into the best possible state school? And then we don't pay 7 years of fees. We don't have 7 years of worry, 7 years of fear. We don't have to then worry about little Johnny or little Jenny's younger brother or sister who's 2 years younger. And then if we've sent them to private school, we're going to have to send the other one to private school. And, lots of these middle class families have three, four kids. What are you signing up to? So they go, okay, let's go for the state school thing. And it doesn't take that many kids to not go to private school to upset the apple cart within certain areas. I live in lovely middle class commuter land, Hertfordshire, right? A place where we're really lucky. All of the secondary schools here, and there's four in the town that I live, are good. Like they're all good schools. You'll be happy with your child going to any of them. Three of them are excellent. There's not that much in it. My kids don't go to private school. My kids go to state school. I couldn't afford for my kids to go to private school, as I was talking about. The numbers are unbelievable. But what we've seen here, and my kids are both already at secondary school, but from kids who are not in the year that's going into secondary school, is that there were loads of kids who didn't get places in their hometown, even though there's four secondary schools, and are then given places in a school they don't want in the next town. And it's like, why has there been this sudden uptick? Because actually, this is meant to be a relatively low birth year, and the school should have plenty of places. And I think what it is it's this effect of, even if it's just 10 to 20 pet families going, we're not going to send them to private school, there's just enough places for all the kids that they think who are going to go to state school. So 10 or 20 more causes an issue. And the people who get pushed out are the people who live furthest from the schools because it's done on distance, catchment area. My own daughter, eldest daughter, didn't get into the schools in this town because we are live on the edge of town. Again, it was a different year. It's like the year after, one of the years after COVID. So there's lots of people who've moved out of London, you know, and the people who'd moved into the town but had moved closer to the town centre. So you get pushed out. And the problem with this catchment area thing is that it means that effectively you're paying to get into the school. You know, people will pay to be close to the school. And I must admit, I've always thought that it's better to pay to live closer to a good school to get your child into it than it is to pay for private school fees, if you think that that state school education will be comparable. Because once your children leave home and are out of the school system, you can always sell your house and it'll always be worth more because it's still near to that good school, unless the school has suddenly got worse. So you can get the money back. Whereas with the private school fees, you've sunk that money in and you can't sell your children. It's just not allowed.
You've
However,
thought you,
good
you've
their
thought about that,
education was,
Simon.
you can't sell them to a law firm at the age of 18 or something and say, well, look, I've
No.
spent so much money on this child's
I
education.
want it back.
I want it back, right? You could do that with a house. You can't do that with your 18-year-old child. So yeah, I think it's, and I think the problem is, I actually think there's a problem with the catchment area system. My personal view is that what this does is it creates more of this kind of unfair system where you buy your way in, and it creates more of this system where you're concentrating people into certain areas, and it's massively debilitating for villages, for example, where you get this huge like kind of drain where you only have people with very young children or old people. And all the families in the middle that are so important to the health of the village, you get a bit this kind of hollowing out because they move out to the towns to be closer to the schools. I think it would be better to just have like, right, this is the whole catchment area for the school, and it's not done on how close you are, but it's done on a kind of lottery system. And if I was a parent who lived close to a really good school, I would hate what I just said, but I do believe it would be a fairer system.
As a member of the child free or childless or whatever, I find all this really wildly like there's a system to it. But has this always been the case, or is it, something in more recent years that's become much more pertinent?
I think in recent decades, it's definitely become a more of a thing where parents are more kind of keen on their children to go to, an Ofsted rated outstanding or good school
I
as a
mean, is this since
result.
Ofsted came about then? Because I don't know how old
I think
Ofsted is, but.
I think it's part of it, and I think there's also a part of the property portals, you know, the Rightmoves, etc., that will tell you the nearest schools, the catch. And what they're rated. But these ratings come around in sort of circles. You know, a school might get rated poorly and then have all this money poured into it, maybe a new head teacher, and then all of a sudden that primary school or secondary school becomes outstanding or good. So there's a kind of a little bit of that that goes on. I think most parents do want to move into an area where it's kind of A, easy for them, their children to get in, to go to school, but also that it's a good school. I mean, we moved into our home 10 years ago. We didn't have children. We had no aspirations to have children. Children weren't, the talk of children wasn't on the radar. It just so happens we sort of bought a house that's within a mile of a good school. For me, it's always been important to be able to walk to school. I think it's nice to be able to walk to school. It's just a thing for me. I used to walk to primary school, and I think it's quite a nice thing. And people are willing to pay more. in order to be near a good school. And actually, case in point, I had a friend of mine who recently moved into the town I live in from another town that's about 5, 10 miles away, because the schools in that area weren't very good. And his son starts school this September, and he was in a rush to buy a property in this postcode in order to get into one of the primary schools in this town, and kind of ended up buying a home he wasn't even all that bothered about. They just needed somewhere. Which probably goes back to our previous chat about the surveyors and what things are worth. He just wanted to get into this town, in order for his son to start primary school education, not in the place that they lived previously. So you can see how it shapes all this. And I remember actually, Georgie, it was probably about 10 years ago. There was a bit of hoo-ha in one of the towns nearby I was living here, and I read about it in the local news, and I did a story about it for This Is Money, in which they changed the catchment area of this school. So the boundaries, they had a massive change of the boundaries of this primary school, and overnight people that were no longer in this catchment area were now in the catchment area of a not as good school. I saw their house prices values wiped, and they were asking whether or not they could sue the council for changing the catchment area. You can understand it though, because if you pay X
Well, that's
amount,
how important it is,
it's
isn't
almost
it?
like you've got a child that's 1, 2, 3, or 4. You've paid what you would say a slight premium to go and try and get into the catchment area of a school that you've really got your heart set on, and then that catchment area changes, and then all of a sudden the house is not worth as much. A crazy, crazy scenario. And actually, looking at these figures, which is a Santander research, if you break it down across the country, in London people were willing to spend an extra 81 grand in order to be near a good catchment
Oh.
school, and in the southeast 58 grand, in the east 50 grand. That's quite a lot. And actually, such is the climate. So this is a phenomenon that's actually
How do
grown.
you work that out? Does someone ask you, like, how much extra would you pay? Oh, eighty-one grand,
We
like.
worked it out by the survey, and then sort of added it onto the average house price across the country. But actually, this Santander research, it showed that the number willing to pay a premium to secure a premium spot in one of these catchment areas, 73% of people with children or starting families willing to pay the premium, compared to 63% last year. And that's been largely pushed up because of the private school changes, but also because parents just want their children, they want the best for their children on the whole. But it also, in this research, it says such is the clamour for to place the top school that some parents say they would be willing to pay an extra 25% on the average home price tag, which is 75 grand on the typical property across the country. That's quite nuts, isn't it? That's quite a lot of money. But as Simon says, it works out far cheaper than private school education, because private schools are so expensive. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, is there any way, Simon, that we can fix this system?
Well, I think we're in the process of fixing it at the moment with an incredibly low birth rate.
All right,
We're
there we go.
probably,
Boom, just don't have babies.
well, I mean, we are shifting
Few
actually
knock-on
towards.
effects elsewhere, but
Well, we are shifting towards a scenario where some of these schools are going to turn out to be undersubscribed in the future. And this is what was interesting about what I was talking about with us, is that they had said in the last, certainly I think this year and maybe the year before, that all kids should get the places that they wanted because there were less kids. Because you get high birth years, you get low birth years, but the trend is going down. And you've seen obviously less children of European parents because families have gone home after Brexit, some of them, or more families haven't come in their place after Brexit. And this has happened in London, for example, where you're getting primary schools that are dropping classes, so they might have had two dropping forms, sorry. So you might have had two form entry, they go down to one form entry, and sometimes they're closing. We went to my girls' old primary school in London the other week for a celebration of the school because sadly the whole school is closing, doesn't have enough pupils. It's compounded by the fact that it's a Catholic school. So obviously, you did have a lot of European Catholic children there. So that effect I talked about has happened. And then also, I think because parents thought that because it was a Catholic school, their kids wouldn't get in. And so they didn't apply for it or got put off applying for it, which is sad, really, because actually, because it was a Catholic school, there were less people, they did end up with less demand. And you could have got yourselves into a really, really good school quite easily. But this is not an isolated incident. It's happening to schools all across London. And it's not happening at the moment, in the kind of commuter belt and in other places, but it will filter out. It does, this stuff does always filter out. So, there is the suggestion, for example, around here that the council has a cunning plan to eventually shut one of the secondary schools and then flog the land off for housing because they know that there's in 5 years' time there's going to be that much less kids and it's prime housing land because it's near the centre of town.
That's it for part one.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
Welcome back. Are you saving enough for your age? Everyone knows that the amount that you should have in an easy access account is 3 to 6 months of your income. Or is it post-tax income? Or is that essential expenditures? Either way, that is the commonly accepted figure. But, Lee Boyce, is it true for everyone? Apparently not. If you're in your 60s, plus, you're looking at between 1 and 3 years worth of savings. So, Lee, drill into this if you would. How much do we need to have saved?
Yeah, so this is some Hargreaves Lansdown data, actually. And as you said, the rule of thumb, 3 to 6 months worth of essential spending and cash savings to cover you. The adage of that usually is, if your boiler was going to break down or if you're going to need car repairs and all of that kind of stuff. But also, if you do lose your job and you need to kind of survive for a bit as well, it's the kind of sum that you would need in order to do this. But I think that what they're getting at in this research is that over 60s shouldn't blindly follow that rule of thumb and think that 3 to 6 months worth of essential spending and cash savings is enough to cover them. It's because savers who reach the age of retirement stop working are usually on a lower fixed income. If you are hit with cost of living, you'll need to dip into your savings. It will take longer to rebuild them if you're in that over 60s category and not working. So as a result, they sort of crunched some numbers on this and had a look at what 3 to 6 months of savings looks like for different age groups. It peaks in your 40s. So in your 40s, a 3 months worth of essentials is about $7,000. And 6 months is about $14,000. The reason why it peaks in your 40s is because you're more likely to have children living at home, your outgoings are likely to be higher. It's probably when you have a higher mortgage on a family home. That doesn't fit everyone, and that doesn't necessarily, it's not the same thing, but it is typically when your expenses are the most at their peak. And actually in your 30s, it's not much lower than that. It's 6,800, 13,500 between 3 and 6 months. In your 20s, it's 4,800 for 3 months and 9,600 for 6 months. And then in your 50s, it starts to dip away a little bit, just over $5,000 and just over $10,000 for 6 months. But this is when it starts to get a little bit kind of like, whoa, how much do I need to have saved in having cash savings? So for 60s and over, they're saying that 1 year's worth of expenses is £16,704. And they're saying that 3 years, it's $50,000. So ideally you would have between those two sums tucked away in your 60s. Going to be hard if you reach 60 or you reach into your 60s and you haven't begun. But if you were kind of in your 20s, 30s, 40s and started tucking away money in this kind of like savings buffer type fashion, it wouldn't be as difficult. As you say, keep it easy access. But the one thing I would definitely implore is, A, make sure that you're utilising your cash ISA. That goes without saying. The other thing I would say is that we have just had the base rate cut. Savings providers have been absolutely swinging away at rates to the point now where the big banks, some of the big banks are offering, wait for it, Georgie, 1% again on your savings.
Ooh.
If you have your money in one of those big banks, please don't leave it in there getting 1%. So make sure you're not.
When you think about inflation and where that's at the minute.
Well, exactly, yeah. And the thing is, actually, in this, I thought this was higher than I expected, but maybe it's because of the kind of people that Hargreaves were sort of asking, but almost 2,000 people have built a decent emergency savings safety net to support them if life takes a turn for the unexpected. I mean, unsurprisingly, young savers are more likely to fall short. Between 20 and 24, 30, it says here only 31% hold enough cash. I think that's quite a large sum for in your early 20s when you might be coming out of a lot of student debt, when you might be kind of finding your way in the world and not on particularly high wages. Cost of living is obviously still not exactly cheap. It's definitely a difficult part of your life, but those figures are quite, I would say, quite encouraging. I think that feels quite high. And I'd be very, very, very surprised if 2/3 of adults in this country have a decent emergency savings safety net, if I'm being quite honest, looking at this research. Feels high.
I mean, they're so individual, which is why I think that personal finance experts and journalists are reluctant to give exact figures for things like how much should you have in your pension, how much should you have in savings, etc., because everybody's different. However, I do think it's quite useful to have just a rough idea and something, if nothing else, to aspire to have. And it just sort of gives an indication here as well about how it is impacted by different ages. And a lot of people, when we speak about that 3 to 6 months, we don't mention sort of actually if you're older. So I think that's always really
Well,
useful
that's
as
what, and
well.
that, exactly,
Right.
and that's what I took from that research, really, because I think the 3 to 6 months is so ingrained. It's one of those like financial mantras, I would say, it's like the top 10 financial mantras that people know. You know, you should have 3 to 6 months save of earnings in a savings account. People know, kind of, I've heard of that. That's why I think what Hargreaves are getting at here is that, but there is a massive asterisk on that if you're older. And actually, you should be thinking it in a 1 to 3 year savings buffer rather than a 3 to 6 month savings buffer. This is what the whole thing was about.
And also wonder if sort of that figure would be slightly higher for the self-employed, etc. Anyway, let's talk Oasinomics. Elsewhere, in 2023-24, the world got Swiftonomics. That was the financial impact of Taylor Swift's Eras Tour. Forget ticket sales, which were massive. Some analysts suggest that in the US alone, consumer spending tied to the tour, such as travel, hotel, and food, passed 5 billion. When you factor in all the indirect spending, it's double that. Just 6 nights in LA alone is said to have supported 3,300 jobs. Such is the power of big events. And the one I always quote is Liverpool's run to the 2019 UEFA Champions League final, which injected approximately 575 million into the UK economy. Most of that, just under 500 million, Liverpool City Centre. But Oasis, the big gig. Who has been to the gig, Simon? Lee, did you get to go?
I didn't go, Georgia. I haven't been. I'm more of a
All
blur
right.
boy.
I went to see Oasis. I went with one of my best friends. It was great. It's brilliant.
Well, I will ask you about the gig itself, but more about the finances, because it's expected to bring a staggering 1.1 billion into the British economy, boosting struggling high streets, bars, shops, and city centres, which incidentally is a very similar figure to how much Taylor Swift was meant to have boosted the UK economy too. So, Simon, mint, huh? Isn't that what they say up north? Explain. Lee, stop laughing at me. Sharp.
Yeah, I could do this entirely in Oasis cliches about how businesses were mad for it. So the figures in here come from Barclays. Manchester, apparently, the gigs piled around £302 million into the area. Wembley, seven sellout shows, 90,000 people, I think the capacity was for each of those gigs. Anticipated to rake in at least £476 million in total for the London economy and all businesses and stuff like that. These are huge sums. Cardiff worth 112 million, Edinburgh worth 151. These are huge sums, and it's really interesting. And it shows the power of something like this to deliver economic growth and get the spending going. Obviously, a big chunk of this spending actually came almost a year ago when they, in the most Oasis possible way, did the biggest ticket sales event of the year and still somehow managed to bodge it and piss everybody off. You've got to love how they managed to do this. They rushed it. One weekend, it was Oasis are going to play a load of gigs. Next weekend, we're selling the tickets. I would have maybe left a little bit of time between those two events in order to get things right. Instead, they upset loads of their fans by doing this kind of pre-sale thing where people did manage to get pre-sale codes. Some people didn't get pre-sale codes. People who did get pre-sale codes couldn't get in anyway. And instead of coming up with some system like, literally just like, a lot of people do it as simple as join the mailing list. Or if you buy the album, you get a code. Bearing in mind they were re-releasing one of the old albums, they could have done that. It's not a perfect way. It still means loads of people can do it, but it throttles it, and it means that you're more likely to only get their genuine fans going. My friend got my ticket off somebody who bought the tickets and didn't even want them. Did manage to get through all of this, but actually kind of knew at the time that he probably wasn't going to be able to go. And my friend kept on him for months. And eventually, when he did say, I can't go, sold the tickets to him. But we were talking about this yesterday. I don't know about these numbers. Right, figures here. Each gig worth an average of 64 million. 90,000 people at Wembley. What do you reckon people paid on average for a ticket? I was going lower at 150 because I think most people
Really?
probably paid. I think most people paid face value, and face value was under that. Lee and Helen argued for more because they said, yeah, but you've got to bear in mind the people who got caught out by the dynamic
Way
pricing
up.
and then all of the hospitality tickets and everything like that. So say we went for a 250 average on ticket prices, right? Which I think is quite high. 250 times 90,000 is 22.5 million pounds. So you've still got to get another 40 million and a bit out of here, right? Now, I read something that said they were selling 250,000 pints a night at those gigs, and I think it was £8 or £9 a pint. So let's say £9 a pint, just to give the benefit of doubt. Well, that would be another 2.25 million. So you still need to raise nearly another 40 million. Merch, people spending around Wembley, obviously, places like Box Park and all the pubs and restaurants and everything were busy. Then people coming into London. There was certainly a lot of people in London that day. But was there enough people each day spending extra money in London to do an extra 40 million pounds? I mean, okay, you've got travel costs, train fares, hotels, and the hotel prices are being blamed for potentially driving up the inflation number off the back of this. But it still felt a bit steep to me. The one thing I would say, it would be ill of me to mention that I went to see Oasis, and for someone of my generation to say that without, of course, saying that I did see them at Nebworth in 1996 as well.
And of course, back then when Oasis played Nebworth, companies like Barclays didn't hold the details on whether there was Arkidonomics because everyone was just paying in shillings and banknotes, so it was hard to keep track.
Oh, no, we actually bartered for our tickets. I paid in chickens and grain.
Question is, Simon, was it as good the second time round?
I've seen them a few times. They were absolutely brilliant. Unbelievably good. Like, the energy was really great. It was basically a massive sing-along in a football stadium. You couldn't really hear anything that Liam or Noel were singing, but they were back to their kind of like that real hardcore energy wall of sound kind of thing. As for how it compares to like Nebworth, I really can't remember that much about that, like what it sounded like at that Nebworth gig, because it was a very long time ago. It was good though.
The only time I've ever seen Oasis was in Bangkok. Don't remember that much about it. I think Franz Ferdinand were also playing, and the one from Stone Roses, what's his face? Anyway, trips down memory lane. Finally, Lee, this one's for you. I read this story and was like, I can't let this go because I remember you moaning about it. I mean, thinking about all the things you moan about, there's a lot, but this one specifically. This is all about self-checkouts at supermarkets, if they're not annoying enough. Now you've got a camera in your face. You've got a reader who has written in and wants to know basically, is a supermarket legally allowed to film me without my permission? And how long can they store the footage for? While I was using the self-checkout at the supermarket, an item I scanned and put it into my shopping bag did not match the expected weight. The console beeped and played back a video of me trying to put the item into my shopping bag. I was embarrassed and worried people would think I was trying to steal. It's weird. I've never seen it replay back to you. That's a new one on me.
VAR slow motion of her
Yeah,
tomato.
exactly. Let's look at it from different angles. Did she steal it? I mean, if it's beeping off, I mean,
I
that's the
don't think
time
it's
when you
caught.
actually should steal, isn't it? Because if it's showing you an
Yeah.
instant replay, it's not filming you, is it? I'm not saying you should ever steal, by the way. It's a damning indictment that we need these cameras and shows how much is being stolen from supermarkets. So I have immense sympathy for the supermarkets and anyone who works in those stores that has to deal with those sort of things. I think it must be horrible. But Lee, can they film us and show VAR replay?
First of all, can I just say, you say moaning. I think it's more constructive feedback on
All right,
things
fine.
that are happening
Whatever
in
you call
life,
it, Lee.
happening in life that are annoying people, firstly. Second of all, how did we go from Simon getting to talk about rock and roll and Oasis and things to me getting the bum deal here talking about cameras in the
It's how I
supermarket?
see you two,
This
you know.
is the
Simon is the
absolute
cool
yin yang of
skateboarder.
like yin yang of like life, this of
Yeah.
stories. I can't believe that you've landed me in it like this. Listen, the self-checkouts are fine. If you have a few items and you want to get in and out, let's get going, right? You know, that's absolutely fine. Of course I use self-checkouts. It's not like I avoid self-checkouts. What I don't like is self-checkouts when you've got a bigger shop and it just doesn't make any sense. So for example, at the weekend I did something that I seldom do. Big shop, the one with the orange logo. Took the kids in, so I had a 6-year-old with me, and I had my 15-month-year-old baby in the trolley, trying to keep them both entertained. I found it quite fun. I quite enjoyed it. Solo dadding around, mucking around, absolutely fine. They have, for whatever reason, decided to strip out almost all of the manned tills. There's now about 30 self-checkout tills and about 5 manned tills. That is fine in a smaller supermarket, in my opinion, Georgie, but not in one of these gigantic ones where people go in on a weekend
Yeah.
and fill up their trolleys and do not want to be scanning all of it. It makes no sense. And then these cameras have become more and more intrusive when you do the self-checkout. So you can see yourself in those cameras looking absolutely disgusting. You're looking at yourself in those cameras
That's what it's
thinking,
really all about, isn't it, Lee?
do I really look like that? God, this is depressing. So
Yeah.
anyway, someone has written in with this, and we've had Dean Dunham, our consumer lawyer expert, get in touch. And actually, you know, supermarkets and other retailers are allowed to record and use CCTV for legitimate purposes. Of course they are. And we're in what feels like a bit of a shoplifting epidemic at the moment, and it's totally same as you. I feel complete sympathy for supermarkets, for shops, retailers, and the people that work within them. And 99.9% of us are law-abiding citizens, and it feels irritating that we are having more and more of us recorded and kind of feeling like a criminal for doing our shop when we would never dream of stealing anything because we just wouldn't. And of course, the CCTV are a theft deterrence. They're there for staff and customer safety. And of course, we are not saying here, and I would never say there shouldn't be cameras. I do think that the self-checkouts, if the supermarkets are going to push all these self-checkouts on us, then they've really got to trust people to use them correctly rather than shoving a camera within about 10 centimeters of your face. But the supermarket must meet 4 key requirements, according to Dean. Regulate the use of CCTV and handling of personal data, which is GDPR and Data Protection Act 2018. That firstly, the supermarket must be transparent about its use of surveillance. It means prominent signs informing the public that they're being filmed. You will find them everywhere. All of the supermarkets, all the retailers will have that bit covered, of course. Second, their use must be proportionate and not excessive or intrusive. Monitoring the shop floor is allowed, but recording in change rooms, toilets, example, you know, can't do that. Doesn't talk about the cameras at the self-checkout, interestingly, here, though. And could you argue that they're intrusive and excessive? Well, the supermarkets will argue that they're there to protect the company and to make sure that things aren't being stolen. Third, the CCTV footage should be kept up for only as long as necessary, typically no more than 30 to 90 days unless it's needed for investigations. I wouldn't have thought that any of the retailers or supermarkets hold on to the footage for very long because it's a lot of footage to be keeping hold of, and it's
Yeah.
probably quite expensive, I'd imagine. And finally, only authorized personnel should access the footage, and it must be stored securely. Importantly, CCTV footage cannot be used to embarrass or shame individuals, and any such use would therefore be unlawful. So Dean concludes here, showing you the video to clarify that you put the goods in your basket is not, in his view, a breach of any of these. If you feel that your privacy rights are being violated, you can file a complaint with the supermarket, ask for a copy of the CCTV footage. If you're unhappy with that, you can go to the Information Commissioner's Office, the ICO, as it is regularly known, and take your complaint there. Probably, I'm going to argue in this case, would be quite a big waste of time. These supermarkets, retailers, they are litigious, they're backed up to the hilt, knowing what they're doing, you know, making sure that they're not getting sued round the clock for all sorts of things that can happen. They will be well within their rights to do all of this. The choice is yours, though. The choice is yours. If you are unhappy with these cameras being in your face when you're using self-checkouts, you have to just queue for the manned checkout and let these companies know how you feel by huffing and puffing in a queue, eight people deep. And the thing is, when I was in one of these queues at the weekend, I couldn't even sort of like say to like the manager or people going, can you open another till? Because there were no other tills to open. They were all manned.
Yeah.
There's just not enough of them anymore. We've gone from having probably, I would say, 12 to 14, maybe 16 man tills in this supermarket. I think I counted five. That's a massive change. That's a massive shift. And of course, self-checkouts, I would suspect, mean low overhead costs, you know, in terms of having to employ people to actually put your shopping through, and hence why it's gone down that route. And as I say, Georgie, listen, it's like a lot of things in life you think I moan about. I am happy to use a self-checkout. I am happy to use contactless payments. What I'm not happy about is when we get pushed towards it and there's no other option.
Yeah.
And that increasingly feels like it's happening year on year and year. Things get chipped away. You know, and I just want to be able to pay for my big supermarket shop in the regular way rather than having to do it all myself, which feels like I'm not the employee of the supermarket. I'm going to stop
no,
my
it's fine.
Constructive criticism of life.
These cameras to me feel a bit more behavioural economics than they do actually trying to stop people stealing, because having worked in a supermarket and having seen people steal stuff, they will just have a hold all bag and they'll shovel it all in. They're not going to the tills. But what it's doing is it's just, they are moving everyone away from manned tills onto these self-checkouts. And so it's basically saying, we're watching you, even if they probably aren't. So I think it's much more about preempting the fact that people who don't normally use these tills might be tempted to put something in our basket or take something, then we are watching you. But yeah, like I said, I don't know how much of their percentage of stolen goods is actually going through people using those sort of self-checkouts. Because let's be honest, as you said, you can't really put a lot in them. You know, they're so tiny. Anyway, Simon, stat of the week.
3.7 million. That's my stat of the week. No, it is not what somebody spent on beer at an Oasis concert. It is the number of investors being stung by dividend tax as they breach the reduced £500 tax-free allowance. Number of individuals paying tax on dividend payments is expected to reach a record 3.67 million in the last tax year, according to a Freedom of Information request by Quilter. This is owing to the fact that the dividend tax-free allowance has gone from £2,000 to just £500, which has pulled in a huge amount more. That figure is double 2 years earlier after the cuts to the dividend tax-free allowance. And the next time you hear someone moaning about Rachel Reeves and Labour, just remember it was Jeremy Hunt and the Tories that did this one.
Right. That's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. but we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.